Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of April 28th. This week is our spring books issue, and as a special treat, we have an excerpt from an interview conducted on Sirius Radio by Sister Marie Pappas with Jim Keane, SJ, a editor here at America, as well as Angela O'Donnell, a Fordham University professor who has also been a guest here on our podcast. So they will be discussing their top 10 Catholic novels. This show was recorded about a month ago, and Sirius was kind enough to let us use it. So without any further ado, here's Jim and Angela along with Sister Marie Pappas.
We're talking about Catholic novels. So what would make a novel Catholic? Is it because the author is Catholic that it becomes a Catholic novel? Because the characters are portrayed as being Catholics? The plot is Catholic, whatever a Catholic plot is. I think a Catholic plot is the Paschal Mystery, is it not? I don't know. What's a Catholic plot? Is it the setting? What is it that makes a novel a Catholic novel?
Well, what I often tell my students is you have to distinguish between a novelist who is Catholic, a novel that is Catholic, and a Catholic novel.
Now you've got me confused. I hope I don't have to take an exam here.
Is that someone like F. Scott Fitzgerald, baptized Catholic, there are some themes that come up in his writing that could be identified as Catholic, but I wouldn't call The Great Gatsby a Catholic novel. Whereas someone like Willa Cather is not a Catholic, but is writing about the American prairie experience, American experience in the Southwest, and those novels are very strongly Catholic themes. So what I always tell them is that the novelist, for my course at least, the novelist has to be a Catholic, and there have to be certain Catholic themes. And those vary from book to book, but what I always like to pick out as the big ones are, first of all, it should be sacramental in its imagination, in the sense that there should be physical objects that have the ability to impart grace. And that can be through the actual representation of the Catholic sacraments, or it can be through a sort of imitation. Flannery O'Connor once said that the best way to depict a baptism for an audience that is not familiar with sacramental theology is to show someone drowning. Which is shocking, but
yeah, it is. That was my inner reaction when you said that. Show someone drowning,
and
I would think of water as life giving, not drowning, killing a person.
Well, in the same way, in one of J.F. Powers' novels, he depicts a priest's ordination as the bishop hitting him in the head with a golf ball, and so I think it can also be comic in that sense. But I'm sure Angela also has some other categories she would add to that.
Okay, what makes the novel Catholic?
Yeah, Jim brings up an interesting case with The Great Gatsby. In some ways, when I teach Catholic novels, I try to make the distinction between novels that are intentionally Catholic and those that are unintentionally Catholic,
like Anonymous Christians. Anonymous Catholic novels?
Well, in the sense that you have writers like F. Scott Fitzgerald, who was, is culturally conditioned in a way by the church. His aesthetic landscape, his sense of the world is very much shaped by the church. And even though he doesn't write about Catholic themes, it can be argued, and it has been argued by some writers, that he is a Catholic, that Jay Gatsby is this figure, this alien figure who doesn't fit into the world. It's trying very hard to make a lot of money and buy into the Protestant work ethic American dream, but really doesn't have a clue as to what it all means, and that ultimately his is a more sacramental world that he's valuing.
A question for Angela. This is Jackie, the producer. Isn't there some belief that Gatsby was Jewish?
His background. Well, there is, there's a little bit of mystery in terms of Jay Gatsby's background. Yeah, this is true. But in terms of Fitzgerald's and the way that Fitzgerald shapes him as an outsider. Yeah, yeah, very much so. I think that there are people like Fitzgerald who sort of write in an unintentional way out of their Catholicism. Mm-hmm. But they're the ones that I like to teach, like as in the case with Jim, are those who are fully aware, they're very conscious of their identities as Catholics. They engage that world that they've been brought up in. Quite unconsciously, they do engage the world in a sacramental or in an analogical way. There's a kind of sense in which the world bodies forth the divine in all people and all things. Mm-hmm. And as a result, these tend to be very, I'm looking at my list, these are very messy, messy worlds that these people occupy. Mm-hmm. They're novels about drunks and bums and failures and people who make a mess of their lives in many ways, but always there's grace evident in these people's mm-hmm. lives. And I think of that as being a very Catholic kind of theme that we see over and over again.
And that sacramental perception is really singularly Catholic. The other thing I was thinking as I was preparing for our discussion today and reading through some notes that Jackie had put together for me, I said to myself, you know what I think is a common string? I was trying to anticipate what the two of you might end up saying. The sacramental, I resonate with immediately, but the other is there's a particular anthropology that is Catholic. And Angela, you were just kind of referencing that, that life is messy, that people are drunks. And so we talk about, we Christians talk about the fact that to be human is to be sinful. And so you're going to clearly see that in the novels. But sinful but redeemed, sinful but there's a dignity. And I kind of saw that theme playing through at least the books that Jackie had me looking at. So I wonder if that wouldn't be another thread that runs through Catholic novels.
You know, I'm reminded of the epigraph that Graham Greene put at the beginning of The Power and the Glory, which is a quote from Robert Browning that... our interests on the dangerous edge of things, the tender murderer, the penitent thief, the superstitious atheist. And I think that describes what you were saying very well, sister, is a lot of these books, Catholic novels, do tend to be on that dangerous edge of things thematically between a messy world and a transcendent world.
So, okay, let's stay with Graham Greene's novel, The Power and the Glory. This is not, well... Jackie characterizes it as not being exactly orthodox, but I would say, you know, you're not talking about Catholic ideals here. You're talking about the reality. And so you have an alcoholic priest who fathers a child. Now, in modern times, that doesn't sound so scandalous, but I'm sure there was a time when that would be quite scandalous. And then, well, you give us the synopsis, either one of you, about that novel. Angela.
Well, the messiness is certainly there from the very beginning. The so-called whiskey priest, who interestingly is never
whiskey
named.
Whiskey priest, good.
Never named. And he is he's in Mexico during the Civil War, during the Revolution, in one of the southern states, which is one of the most anti-Catholic places to be. And he's living his very messy life, trying as best he can to live out his faith and to give the sacraments to the people in the villages that he meets along the way. He's a sort of pilgrim who's moving his way through Mexico. And he's also being chased by his nemesis, this lieutenant who wants to arrest him and wants ultimately to execute him. And along the way...
Why is he being pursued by the police? Why is he going to be arrested?
Because of the fact that it's a revolution that is a Marxist revolution at root.
Oh, okay, got it.
And the church is the enemy. Mm-hmm. And so they're trying to rout out anybody who's practicing the sacraments, and particularly the priests. So he finds himself among the last, and he thinks that this is pretty pathetic because he's not a very good priest. He's very well aware of his flaws. But there's this process of conversion that happens gradually, and it's a very messy process. Along the way, he meets this Judas figure, one of the most moving scenes of the novel, who ultimately is the one who turns him in. And this figure is confessing to him, and it's a confession the priest doesn't want to hear because he conflates little things like not going to Mass on Sunday with things like pederasty, you know, and the priest is thoroughly disgusted by the ways in which we really can't even get our sense of sin correct. And he says this wonderful thing. He acknowledges the fact that it was too easy to die for what was good or beautiful, for home or for children or for a civilization. It needed a God to die for the half-hearted and for the corrupt. And he understands the incarnation in a very practical way at that moment when he realizes that Christ dies for the mestizo just as surely as he will die for this man who will betray him. So it's a real trial by fire. But in the end, when he finally is executed publicly, there is a sense with him of having worked out his salvation in fear and trembling and at least having an understanding of what it is that he's been trying to do.
Well, I think sometimes in my own ministry as a religious educator, that sometimes the ordinary Catholic gets the notion that to be a good Catholic, you have to be perfect. And so sometimes it costs, especially teenagers. For 18 years, I taught teenagers, and it was like they didn't even try after a while because they knew they couldn't be perfect. So there was no sense trying. So they kind of divorced themselves from the whole effort of trying to live as a Catholic. But what I see in these Catholic novels and what they illustrate so beautifully is the real human condition, the fact that nobody is perfect, but it's not a reason to give up striving for goodness and virtue. And in this story, you know, being heroic, because this priest in the end, as I understand it, is quite heroic. Am I right?
Not only heroic, but then despite his own weaknesses, becomes sort of a member of the communion of saints for the Mexican people. His relics are distributed. The stories of his martyrdom are told and retold. And in the end, the very final scene of the book, you get a sense that this young boy who has been very anti-clerical and has looked up to the lieutenant of the Marxist forces, he spits on the boot of the lieutenant. And you can see him turning back to the faith and turning back to the heritage of his country and his faith and his people's beliefs.
So it's sinners who become saints.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's thanks for reminding me of that ending, Jim. That's such a wonderful moment, too. The very last scene in the book, there's a knock at the door, and this young boy answers it, and there's another nameless priest at the door. Do what you want. The church isn't going away. The saints aren't going away. They're always with us. So it's a very powerful, very affirmative conclusion, despite all of the muck and mire you've had to go through in order to get there.
So tell me something. Does The Power and the Glory by Graham Greene make your list?
It's number 3 on mine.
Number 3 on
and
yours.
It's number 1 on mine.
Number 1, oh.
But I should admit that a lot of the plot is based on a Jesuit, Miguel Pro. Especially the scene of the execution and the chase through the mountains. And so I have a particular affinity for it that maybe everyone wouldn't share.
Oh, so when we judge our books, our Catholic books, some of our own sensibilities come into it where they rate. But you both agree that this is one of the top 10 Catholic novels. So let's see. What about number 2? Jim, what's your number 2?
A book from the early 60s, Mort d'Urban, by J.F. Powers, who was a great, great writer. He only put out 2 novels in his life, but did a lot of short stories. And it's the story of a priest who struggles a lot with the material comforts of the world and achieving glory for himself, but then in the end sort of comes to a realization about the spiritual value of life through a number of personal failings and catastrophes.
Oh, so there we have that broken human condition again.
Absolutely.
And what is the title of this book?
Mort d'Urban. His name is Urban. It's a play on Mort d'Arthur.
Okay, Mort d'Urban. And Angela, you have that as your number 2?
No, actually, Powers did not make my list.
Didn't make your list at all?
No, not at all.
Not on your list.
He's a wonderful writer, but he's a writer who I think of as having... like Jane Austen, who also does this very well, he has a very, very small canvas on which he works. And in some ways, I don't know if a lot of non-Catholic readers would enjoy reading Powers. I don't think his work really transcends the little world that he creates as readily as these other writers that I have on my list.
And so your number 2 is?
My number 2 is a book, actually, that was very, very popular, despite the fact that it's about a little priest.
These priests feature in all these books so far. Go ahead.
It's a very Catholic book, but it was phenomenally popular in 1937 when it came out. It's by a French writer named Georges Bernanos, and it's called The Diary of a Country Priest.
Ah, yes. Now, that's what I'm familiar with.
And it was made into a beautiful movie in 1951 by Robert Bresson. So mm-hmm. Most people who don't know the novel definitely know the film. And it's such a beautiful novel in so many ways. For one thing, it is of these 20th century books that I've chosen, it's one of the most affirmative, if not the most affirmative one on the list. The priest, like the priest in The Power and the Glory, is very imperfect, very flawed, has very little sense of his own ability to be effective in the community that he's in. People are bad Catholics, too, in the countryside. Their besetting sin is boredom, the sin of acidia, really, of sloth.
Mm-hmm.
How do I get these people galvanized with the love of God? This is his problem. Mm-hmm. And, of course,
it's every priest's problem.
Every priest and every teacher's problem.
Yeah, there you go. No, but teachers sometimes do manage to get the exceptional student who gets A's and gets into the best college. So once in a while, the cream does rise to the top in the classroom. But for a priest, I mean... You never get a whole church full of saints, and there's always plenty of sinners in the world who aren't in the church, and even those who are in the church are not like your picture perfect Catholic. So, Yeah, I think it's hard to, this is interesting. I think it's hard to be successful as a priest. Your work is never done.
Yeah.
You hear that, Jim? Your work is never done.
I will admit that if you looked at the list, I think Angela's list and mine, is that you've looked at the authors themselves. No one would consider them a list of very, very perfect Catholics. Mm. Uh-huh. They are themselves very flawed characters, too, and I think that comes across in their work.
Well, I'm beginning to think there is no such thing as a perfect Catholic. Perfect meaning complete. Nothing more can be added. Nothing is missing. You know, we talk about God as being perfect and complete, but I think it's unrealistic to. And that's why I reference the whole anthropology that runs through these Catholic mm-hmm. novels. The recognition that to be human is to be limited, to tend to be sinful. And yet in these books that you're talking about, there is always the ideal too, the desire for something more. Am I right? That you see running through these.
Absolutely.
What about number three, Jim?
I had Walker Percy's The Moviegoer, which is actually from the same era as J.F. Powers. There was a period of about 5 years from the late 50s to the early 60s where these Catholic novels were winning the National Book Award every year.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
What was going on then? What years are we talking about?
59 to 64.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's a period of a lot of theological ferment, of a lot of intellectual ferment.
Mm-hmm.
The, sort of the first generation of American Catholic intellectuals who really moved into the public sphere. In the case of Walker Percy, The Moviegoer is really an extended philosophical meditation about someone caught in an endless cycle of repetition who really ends up deciding to do the noble thing very late in the novel and become sort of what Kierkegaard would call a knight of faith, a person who takes up their responsibilities in life rather than just sort of wasting their time in that bored life that Angela referred to from Diary of a Country Priest.
Mm-hmm. Angela, what about you? What's number three on your list?
Well, actually, my number three was The Power and the Glory.
So, oh, that's right. Yeah. So you get to do number four then.
So I can move down to my number four. Evelyn Waugh's Bride's Head Revisited, which was published in 1945.
I want to know why.
okay, tell us about this Catholic novel.
Waugh said of the book, it's a book about God. So that kind of gets us started in the right direction. It's a story. It's a very, very English novel. This is one of the reasons I like to have it on the list, because most of mine are by Americans. Very English novel in the sense that he traces the history of this family, this very wealthy landowning family, the Flights, Lord and Lady Marchmain and their four children. And each of the children, once again, well, except for Cordelia, the youngest, who is the closest to a saint that you'll find, I think, in modern fiction. Each of them is terribly flawed in some way. Each of them is really trying to flee from the church in some way. And Lord Marchmain is the father. But the language is overtly theological. One of the chapters is entitled The Twitch of the Thread, coming from the Psalms, the sense in which no matter how far away these people get from God, he just twitches the thread and he brings them back.
Isn't that neat?
Yeah, so it's a wonderful, again, very affirmative novel in that all of these people are, grace works its way through their lives. They may accept it and they may not. That's up to them. That's mm-hmm. their choice. But it is this story that we're talking about that happens over and over again.
So this relentless lover God who's always trying to pull us back, but with a thread, you know, it's not a force, but just kind of cajoling us back, you know, the gentle tug. Yeah, pretty much true of life, pretty much true of the whole Catholic perception of the sacramental way in which God does use all of life and people as threads to kind of pull us back toward him.
Absolutely.
So, Jim, what about you and your number four?
Number four, I have one that's probably on a lot of people's list. That would be Flannery O'Connor's Wise Blood.
Oh, now tell me about that one.
Well, Wise Blood is, there's not a Catholic in the story, but it's set in the South. It's a young man who sets up a church, the Church Without Christ, he calls it, and he goes around preaching. And over the course of the novel, he runs into a series of people and events that remind him of some of his own sin. And he makes this very drastic decision near the end to atone for his sins by taking on the sort of mortifications of other people. And in a very dramatic scene, he blinds himself and then spends out the rest of his days living as this blinded man, taking on all these punishments for himself. And it met with a lot of controversy when it came out. A lot of Catholics didn't like it. Certainly a lot of Christians didn't like it. But I really think it's O'Connor's signature work in terms of how it deals with these ideas of sin, redemption, grace, the messiness of the human condition, and also this idea of, she always spoke of the Christ-haunted South, not the Christ-filled South, the Christ-haunted South, mm-hmm. in the sense that her characters were always striving for an ideal and were very complicated.
Angela, do you agree with that, that Wise Blood would be a significant top 10 Catholic novel?
Well, it's interesting. Flannery O'Connor is on my list, but mm-hmm. I didn't put Wise Blood on my list because I cheated. I actually styled my list the 10 most significant works of Catholic fiction in the 20th century, precisely because I wanted to put Flannery's stories in here. Mm-hmm. Wise Blood is a novel that I think everybody recognizes that it has a kind of greatness, but I think most people who value Flannery value her stories. She just works so much, to my mind at least, in terms of the architecture of the work. She works so much better in the short story format than she does in the novel format. In fact, Wise Blood is almost a novella. It's not very long. Mm-hmm. So she really kind of likes Hawthorne, actually, a non-Catholic who had a Catholic daughter, is her main inspiration.
Definitely.
In terms of her writing. She's a romancer, really. She writes these very plot-driven stories, which over and over again demonstrate to us the action of grace in the world, the incarnation on various characters in various situations. And the stories are just mythic almost for us. And for that reason, I didn't think I could possibly put together a list that didn't have her stories on mm-hmm. it. So, sorry.
What does it mean to be Christ-haunted?
Well, I think the image that O'Connor herself liked was the billboard or the bumper sticker image, that would say something about Jesus in the sense that Christ was very much a part of the culture, but that and present in everything, but not necessarily in a vibrant, life-giving way all the time. Oftentimes, it was a Christian faith was a specter that would hang over a person who had great amounts of guilt, or it was a very distant reality. She has a great line in one of her short stories about coming across a woman in the woods and hearing her saying over and over again, Jesus, 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 and how much this other woman regrets it because it seems unseemly to her that would speak the name of Jesus. Mm-hmm. So that idea that Christ is present but not really the dynamic presence that we all profess him to be.
Therefore haunted rather than life-giving.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's a really nice point. The one of her stories, which is called Parker's Back, it was actually her favorite story.
Yes, yes, yes.
The main character, I love the line.
Oh, yes, I love that story.
Yeah, Parker says he was as ordinary as a loaf of bread, and he thought he could make himself extraordinary, holy in a way, by getting this beautiful arabesque of tattoos all over his body, and the only space he didn't cover with tattoos is his back, hence the title, Parker's Back. And when he finally does choose what he wants, he goes into the tattoo parlor and he's looking through all of these various images and he fixates on this image of this iconic image of the face of Christ. Mm-hmm. And it's got the eyes are glowing and there's something that's absolutely mesmerizing to him and he must have this on his back. And part of the reason he does this is because he wants to impress his wife, who is a sort of Gnostic Southern Christian. And he goes home and bears the image to her, thinking, of course, she's going to love him. And she's horrified because mm-hmm. it's a form of idolatry. And she actually beats him with a broom and creates marks on his back so that the image begins to bleed, actually. And he finds himself outside under a tree weeping, not knowing what to do with himself. So there's this desire to know God, to love God, to make God part of one's body, but not really having a clue how to do it and failing at it again and again, but continuing to try. That just... that Christ-haunted sense of, the trajectory of people's lives is really very, very much in Flannery's work.
And that's so true of the Catholic journey, that here we are in the Lenten season and all of us come again to make this journey and to really truly come to know really what it means to be other Christs. And it's so hard to get it right. Mm-hmm. And so these stories pretty much underline our human experience. I think any of us who even dabble with the idea of living our faith are challenged by this frustration of getting it right.
If I could interject, I found that image very striking, Angela, of you have a man with an image of Christ on him bleeding at the foot of a tree.
Mm.
It brings up something,
isn't it?
Something else you see in a lot of these novels is they can be very incarnational in the sense that there can be a figure of Jesus or a reference to the Passion or another one of Jesus' great signs that sort of runs through it. And oftentimes those characters aren't particularly beautiful or profound, but they happen to be there to affect a change in some other character in the story.
Which brings us then to number 5. Who wants to go with 5? Angela?
Well, actually, this is my number 6 because Flannery was my number 5. So.
Oh, so you snuck your 5 in. Well, then, Jim, you get to do your 5, and then we'll let you, Angela, add your 6.
Mine is A Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole, who I kind of see as the American Evelyn Waugh. He only wrote this one book and then a second partial novel that was later published. And he really had Toole really had a great sense of how to demonstrate the struggle for transcendence in the world. And the main character is this very idiosyncratic man who studies medieval philosophy and writes up these sort of outrageous diaries detailing his struggles in life. And living in this chaotic world of New Orleans with a lot of very vibrant characters. And it's a very comic novel, but I really found some of the struggles and some of the scenes in it very profound.
Like, for example, because I'm not familiar with this.
Well, his sort of interlocutor is this communist young revolutionary in New York. And she ends,
I like the setting.
And he considers himself Catholic, but in a sort of an aesthetic sense. He sees the church as the bulwark against the world around him that is collapsing. And at the end of the book, he gets himself in all sorts of trouble. But he's been at one point in the book, he's been inspired by her revolutionary rhetoric, and he goes into a pants factory where he's been hired as an employee and tries to lead a workers' revolt. But he sees himself as Boethius, as Winston Churchill, as this great statesman, and they see him as you know, kind of a fool. And it's just very comic, but also very touching.
Yeah, he's a wonderful figure. He also has a great first name. Ignatius.
Right.
Oh, there you go again.
It's very interesting to me, as I was making this list, how many of these people are named for the saints? How many of the main characters, you know, like Sebastian Flight in Evelyn Waugh's Bridehead Revisited, and he is a suffering soul. He is really a saintly martyr, you know, throughout the thing. Ignatius Reilly, another suffering soul who's outside, comes from the world of the church, but doesn't really belong. His last name is Reilly.
I'm going to interrupt again because the one novel, and I don't know if we're allowed to put two of the same authors on it, but the one novel where the main character and the narrator is so God-haunted is The Heart of the Matter by Graham Greene. Mm. He even asks God to hate him. Mm. So I think that's really very, very moving, how a man could get so despairing as to call out in his anger and belief, hate me. Mm. It's amazing.
Yeah. Mm, I wonder what else is happening there, though. To call out to God, hate me? Mm.
Well, you know, one thing I was talking with my students last week about is that the opposite of love is not really hate, right? It's indifference.
Mm-hmm.
Hate can be kind of close to love in a way. It can involve a certain obsession, a certain desire to be in contact with someone.
That's very true.
And so it's really boredom, which is the opposite of love, not hate, in a way, at least thematically.
Absolutely. I would agree with that. And we do pull people close to us when we hate them. And if I can't succeed at loving God or loving others, then hating them becomes as close as I can get. There you go. That's another movie.
Mm-hmm. Right.
As good as it gets, as close as it gets. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's going to be a resurgence in this kind of Catholic literature? Is that what the two of you are about as teachers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's going on all around us. I think that there are great novels being written right now.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. Ron Hanson is one of the best practicing Catholic novelists right now. His most recent book actually will be out very soon, if it's not out now. It's called Exiles, and it's based on the life of Gerard Manley Hopkins and his friendship with Robert Bridges. It's really a narrative that attempts to deal with this friendship as well as the development of Hopkins as a poet, his struggle as a priest, trying to figure out what his vocation is.
Mm-hmm.
That's following up on several excellent Catholic novels before that, Mariette in Ecstasy, which is on my list. That was
what number is that?
That's number 9. But
oh, number 9. No, we can't jump that far ahead.
The only reason my novels are ranked this way, by the way, is I did them chronologically so that not so much on greatness, but you know, the first one of the century and the last one of the century. So
okay, so yours are chronological. And Jim, how did you rank yours?
I ranked mine by personal preference, to tell the truth, not what I
Oh, so we have
popular,
a real
but,
personal preference.
But I also have Ron Hanson as number 9 with Mariette and Ecstasy, which I also thought was a fantastic novel.
It's a saint's life, really. It's about a young woman in upstate New York at the beginning of the 20th century who begins, she goes into the convent. Her life is loosely based on Saint Therese of Lisieux.
You sure it's not about Sister Marie Pappas?
Well, are you a stigmatist?
Not yet.
Yes, it's a wonderful, at first it seems like a very beautiful, poetic, evocative story of, you know, that particular time and place, and then things start to happen. She receives the stigmata. And I'm sorry to say this, but all hell breaks loose in the convent.
Because I've known that to happen.
Well, for a layperson who doesn't know much about convent life, this is a fascinating sort of psychological study, not only of saintliness, but also of the other dark side of what happens within her community as people question Mariette's, the truth of what it is that she's saying, question her holiness. So it's ultimately a novel that doesn't really tell you whether or not Mariette is saintly or not. There's enough ambiguity there so that you're really not quite sure. Now, Ron Hanson tells us she definitely is, but as D.H. Lawrence tells us, trust the tale, not the teller. And the tale leaves room for ambiguity there so that you get pulled into that world and you really can't. There are no easy answers.
So you can't discern clearly. Mm-hmm. It sounds a little bit like Agnes of Gott.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's some of what has happened beyond these novels, I think, that are playing off some of the earlier or original stories. And your number 9, Jim?
Is also Mariette and Ecstasy by Ron Hanson.
There we go. Now you tell me your take on Mariette and Ecstasy.
Well, you know, I was just reminded when Angela was talking about a friend of mine that I recommended it to who read it. And said, well, I don't understand in these convents that these nuns don't do anything. And in that sense, it can be an introduction to a life of contemplation, because Mariette is 17 and entering an order where her sister is the abbess, where there are nuns ranging from 20 to 80, and their work is prayer. And the way that affects her and changes her life, just the rhythms of prayer and daily life in community, can be very striking. It's in a way, it's by limiting the picture you deal with. Hanson, by limiting his subject, is really opening up what the characters can express.
Right, and deepening it. And isn't there that line in there about a prayer is our craft? Mm-hmm. And well, that would be true of any authentic religious community. Not that, for example, my religious community, the Sisters of the Resurrection, we're not contemplatives, but we refer to ourselves as active contemplatives.
Right.
And so prayer definitely informs our day. We get up very early in the morning so that we have that hour for meditation and then for common prayer and to celebrate the sacrifice of the Mass before we launch our day, and certainly on weekends when we have more time and we're free from the responsibilities of our active ministry, you know, we break our day with prayer. And so I resonate with those elements, but yeah, there are points in this story where she does sound like a little bit off kilter, Mariette. And, you know, you wonder if it's saintliness or sanity here.
Yeah, that's the other thing that I really liked about it. Hanson, when he was writing the novel, was reading the writings of some 19th century stigmatists. And as we know, the saints are odd people, you know. They are not, you know, the kind of ordinary folks that you can sit down and have a beer with in a normal chat, you know. So there's this wonderful sense of Mariette as being, you know, she just goes too far. And that's one of the reasons that everybody kind of knows deep down that she's a saint. Mm-hmm. And I love it, too, when the priest interviews her and says to her, okay, Mariette, you know, you've got the stigmata. Why did God choose you? And her answer is, I don't know. Yeah, that's a mystery to me. I don't understand it. And it's at that point that he's convinced, oh, yes, she doesn't come up with answers. Well, I'm virtuous and I say all my prayers and I, you know, mm-hmm. There's nothing like that. She's as mystified as anybody that this has happened to her. And that's there's a sort of genuineness about that comes through despite all of her weirdness.
Mm-hmm.
And also it blends, the blend that Hanson does of the erotic with the divine love is very important, because that's so evident in Renaissance writings of people like John Donne, who is a closet Catholic, really. There's this kind of sense in which, and of course, John of the Cross, St. Teresa of Avila, that's very much part and parcel of it that he builds into her character.
So in some ways, this story fits the stereotypes of holiness and religious, and there's something pretty mysterious about being a nun. I don't know if in modern times that's still true, but there was a mystique about religious consecration. I hope there still is a bit of a mystique about religious consecration. There should be. There should be, for sure. I live it, and there is. Jim, you have some thoughts on that?
Well, I was thinking when we were talking about when all hell breaks loose in the convent, a joke that is common among Jesuits, and I'm sure also in your order, is that the saints are the holy men and women, and the martyrs are the ones who have to live with them.
Well said. Yes, I would agree with that. Now, let's make sure we do our homework here on Pathways of Learning, because we did skip over number 10, the bottom of the list. Now, I know, Angela, that yours is simple chronological order. So what is number 10 on your list?
My number 10 is actually the last novel published in the 20th century that I think of as being a great Catholic novel is Alice MacDermot's Charming Billy. And MacDermot, as I'm sure you know, she's sort of a local. She grew up in the Bronx and in Long Island.
There you go.
She writes about the little world of Irish Catholics that she knows in the Bronx and on Long Island. And the holiness of little people, the littleness of their lives, the loving detail that she puts into telling the stories of these people who really are modern-day saints. Billy is a holy man. He's a lot like Sebastian Flight in the Evelyn Waugh book, Brideshead Revisited, in the sense that he has problems with alcohol. You know, he's a drunk.
That sounds Irish.
He can't get control over his life. But this is because of a tragic thing that happens to him. He's deceived, and his life is based upon that deception, and trying to live with that deception. And she has builds in all sorts of suggestions that he might have been a priest had things been different. He lives a kind of almost a celibate life, really.
Mm-hmm.
But his love, the love of his life, this Eva person, is raised almost to the level of a god for him. So it's a really touching story.
Very human,
told.
Very yes. real. Very good. And how about your number 10, Jim?
I did love Charming Billy, but my number 10 is a book from the 50s, actually, by Walter Miller. It's a science fiction book called A Canticle for Leibowitz. And it was never a big seller, but it went out of print for a long time, actually. But it is a very compelling book about the survival of the church in monasteries after a nuclear holocaust. And I put it on my list for a lot of reasons, but one of them is that I think the apocalyptic is another theme you see in a lot of Catholic novels. The notion of resurrection and judgment and of renewal and of destruction are, you know, common themes in Scripture and in our spiritual tradition. And so this book really exemplifies the idea of an apocalypse and, you know, the struggle of the church to last through an era when its long traditions of learning and of preserving knowledge and of combining a prayerful attitude towards science and nature really comes under attack from a world that doesn't want knowledge anymore. And it's a funny book, but also a very profound one.
How often does humor play into these Catholic novels? Is that common to see the humorous element?
I think it is. Sometimes I think the humor is understood better if you are a Catholic. Certainly with Alice MacDermot, I think I laugh harder as an Irish Catholic than someone would who wasn't. But I think in a lot of them, certainly in the ones we've mentioned, there's often humor.
Okay, now you both agreed that Mariette in Ecstasy was number 9. So now we're up to number 8. Number 8, who wants to go first?
Number 8 is Mary Gordon's novel, her first novel, Final Payments, which was published in 1979. And this is a novel that's very, very important, I think, was very important for women, because Mary Gordon sort of does what James Joyce did in 1914 with Portrait of the Artist. He gives women Catholics permission, in the way that Joyce gave young male Catholics permission, to really examine their relationship to the church and try to determine how it is that that faith matches up with the real lived existence that they have in the late 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And this is written on the cusp of Vatican II. Mary Gordon sees that happen. She sees what's been lost. But she also realizes that there's much to be gained by this reformation in the church. And one of the things that that she realizes, she comes to know, is there's a kind of theology of the body in this book that is really beautifully demonstrated.
I hope Christopher West is listening.
I hope so, too. A sense in which there's a recognition of the fact that that those very strong Jansenistic elements that mm-hmm. were in the church early in the century take a long time to really be sloughed off, and that they're the sort of things that make women feel very uncomfortable about their own bodies. And this character of Isabel realizes, you know, that that's not the way that she needs to live her life in order to live a holy life.
Mm. Well, actually, that's not a book that I'm familiar with, but you certainly just made me quite interested in it.
Sister, I have a message from Norman from Pennsylvania who called in to let Jim know that when you said Canticle of Leibowitz, he just said he jumped up in the air and he screamed. That was his favorite.
Oh, fantastic.
Great. Wonderful. See, you hit a note there. Good. So, Jim, what about, maybe we'll get another call now. What about your number 8?
Well, first I should add that my number 6 is Final Payments by Mary Gordon.
Oh, okay.
So I also thought it was a fantastic book. And in many ways, kind of a...
So we have both of you voting for Final Payments. I have to read that.
I found it kind of an updating of Wise Blood in a way. A lot of the same themes, but with the main character living in a much less morally certain world. And so having to make some of the same gigantic sacrifices that she expects of herself, but then also moving into a different environment in terms of the church and in terms of her own world. Mm-hmm. But my number 8 is actually by Muriel Spark, Memento Mori.
Now tell us about that.
This is a group of elderly people living in nursing homes and big estates in England. Actually, she's Scottish, but they're in England. And they start getting phone calls that say, "Remember to die." And they don't know what to make of it, and they point out all sorts of suspects. And it's never clear who it is. And finally, one inspector tells them this could be the voice of God or it could be the voice of death. But this reminder of them that they are mortal causes them to act in different ways. And some of them behave very foolishly, but some of them behave very nobly and really change their lives around. And speaking of comedy in Catholic fiction, it is very funny in a very dry sort of way. The Muriel Spark has a very acid tone in her writing, and she can be very funny and almost a little bit heartless sometimes, the way she treats the human condition. But I did find it to be an excellent book.
But again, that thread of the human condition or human anthropology, I mean, I see this running through even our discussion today. So that brings us to number 7. And Jim, I'm going to let you give number 7 before Angela's. I've been letting her go first.
Well, I cheated as well on number 7. And mine is The Prince of Darkness and Other Stories by J.F. Powers. It's not a novel, but it's a collection. Powers was also someone who, like O'Connor, really was a great crafts, you know, could really craft a short story very well. And it's a series of stories, most of them about priests.
Of Darkness is mostly about priests.
The Prince of Darkness is about a very fat priest who, because of his clerical suit, his parishioners call the Prince of Darkness behind his back. But I think all the stories in there are about priests except one that's about a cat.
And what does that tell you?
Yes. And, you know, once again, this Powers' traditional themes, Midwestern life, the experience of the transcendent among the mundane, and stories of redemption and self-knowledge.
Okay, we're getting close to the top of the hour. Angela, what about your number 7?
My number 7 is William Kennedy's Ironweed, which was published in 1979, which is a book about drunks. book about very flawed people. The whole thing takes place on Halloween, All Saints, All Souls Days. Mm-hmm. And a lot of dead people are in the book. And Francis Phelan makes this pilgrimage during which he revisits all of these people from his past. He's also a murderer, by the way. Yet he's a good man. He's a man who's really trying to find God, trying to make his messy way to some sort of recognition of mm-hmm. what it means to be a Catholic, what it means to be holy. So it's a beautiful book, very powerful. A movie was made with Meryl Streep and Jack Nicholson, but it's really a wonderful book to read.
So a lot of these good books then have been made into movies.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
And Jim, what about you?
I seem to be.
Well, no. Now we're on number 6. And Angela, you gave us your number 6 before?
No, it's actually Shisaku Endo's Silence, which Martin Scorsese is working on making a movie. He's been making a movie of this for 20 years.
Well, I have to tell you that I have so thoroughly enjoyed this. Time goes too quickly when we're having fun. But thank you so much for being our guest. I'd love to be one of your students.
Thank you.
And
thank
I
you,
definitely
sister.
Have to get some new books. And until we meet again a couple of weeks from now, may God hold you and all those you love in his embrace. Read some good Catholic novels. God bless.